Okay, we are live with Alexander Mercuris and the fantastic Pepe Escobar. Pepe, how are you doing? Welcome to Duran. And
thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be with you from Southeast Asia.
It is a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. Pepe, where can people follow your work? I mean, I know everyone is very familiar with you. I'm positive about it. But is there anything that you want to plug or anything that you would like to tell our viewers before we get started?
Okay, if you allow me 30 seconds, very quick.
Yeah, take your time. Yeah,
a lot of people knew that I was associated with Asia Times in Hong Kong for 20 years. So it was very easy to find me. I left 4 and something years ago because I had a huge fight with the American bankers who bought Asia Times. For obvious reasons, I would end up leaving. Nowadays, I publish on two Russian media and one West Asia media. I publish at the Cradle in Beirut, and in Russia, Sputnik International in English and Strategic Culture. It's picked up by a lot of people all over, including in the US. So it's easy to find it. It just takes a little bit of effort. And apart from that, my books, you can find my books on Amazon. Yeah. Not very complicated. $7 published in the US. And something that I really would like to plug, not for me, but for understanding Iran. Last year, I shot the first English language documentary on the International North-South Transportation Corridor, which links three BRICS, Russia, Iran. We had full access. I went from the Caspian to the Persian Gulf, to the Gulf of Oman, to the Iran-Pakistani border. And if you, all of you, your audience, if you watch it, you will understand what Iran is all about. It's about trade, connectivity corridors, and peace. It's not about war. That's it. You go to the Press TV website, you go on documentaries, it's over there. It's called the Golden Corridor. And I'm sure it will be very helpful for all of you to really understand Iran. And on top of it, you're going to see Iran from the Caspian to the Persian Gulf and almost everything in between.
Yeah. Fantastic. I will get those links together and I'll place them in the description box and I will comment when the live stream concludes. So a big hello to everyone that is watching us on all the platforms. A big thank you to our moderators as well in the chat. We have a lot to discuss. So Alexander, Pepe, I pass it off to you.
Indeed, and it's an incredible privilege actually to be interviewing Pepe, who I have no hesitation saying is one of the brightest stars in the firmament of independent media. And can I just say,
he's in Moscow, Alex, you remember?
Absolutely. years ago. And can I just also say, his books are wonderful. He is a superb writer, and I think one of the best travel writers. He probably wouldn't want to call himself a travel writer, but he goes traveling from one place to another. He's able to get inside the cultures, the peoples, the landscapes in ways that are almost unique. And of course, he does this always understanding the particular political and geopolitical dimension of the places that he is visiting. So absolutely do look up his books, which are indeed available on Amazon. Now, we're in a period of tremendous conflict. We have two wars going on, one in Ukraine, one in Iran, and it's Iran that we're going to focus upon today. I think we are all agreed that this was a war that was coming. It was going to happen sooner or later. It was clearly shaping up the United States for its own reasons, which are separate, I believe, from Israel's reasons, was determined eventually to attack Iran. The president of the United States, Donald Trump, has, I think, his own personal issues with Iran, which we're perhaps not going to devote a huge amount of time for. But sooner or later, one way or another, this attack was going to happen. And that begs many questions. Why Iran? Why specifically attack Iran? And also, what are the Iranians who have obviously been aware of this and who have prepared for this in advance for some time? what do the Iranians think? What does the leadership think? What is the political stability of the country, which is something that many people have questioned and talked about? And what are their objectives in this war? But let's start with the first question. Why Iran? Mm-hmm. Why is Iran so important? Why did the United States resolve some time ago, for a long time now, that they would attack Iran? Pepe, over to you.
Well, just a little bit of history, Alex. Yeah. And history tells us it's all there. It's the crossroads of Eurasia, the number one crossroads of Eurasia. And now even more because it's considered by the American establishment and the old money and the people who run the show behind emissaries or buffoons like Trump, the key, the absolute key to control the heartland, much more than Russia and China. They cannot obviously go for all-out war against Russia or China. At least they realize that. Not to mention both as peer, not one peer competitor, as the late, oh gosh, Brzezinski used to say, but two peer competitors and in a strategic partnership. Iran is the third pole, and they think they can get it. Now, after 2 weeks, they see that they cannot get it. First of all, because they didn't plan this war properly. The American way of war is shock and awe. Shock and awe maybe work for 30, 35, 40 minutes this time in Tehran. The counterpunch came half an hour later. Why? Because this time they were prepared. During the 12-day war, they were not. They learned their lessons. They studied all their mistakes. And of course, they got extra help, the unseen help, not what we learn from our sources or what is leaked from both Russia and China. Intel in real time, Beidou satellites, tracking every movement of the Americas, including the U.S. Navy. They didn't have that during the 12-day war. So now is another story. Why Iran? Because, number one, Iran is a member of BRICS, full member of Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Strategic partnerships with both Russia and China, detailed. In the case of China, the 400 billion 25-year comprehensive strategic partnership, as the Chinese define it, right? Which basically is energy and infrastructure. We sell you all the energy that you need, and you build infrastructure all over Tehran, which they have been doing it. And very, very special. Very, very special. They trade their energy outside of the petrodollar, which is the key issue. And now we are right in the middle of the whole key issue around this war. Because what the Iranians did with one single move, I interpreted a little bit playfully, if you allow me, as the IRGC reading Sun Tzu and learning how to play Go alongside chess, which the Iranians excel, as you know. One single move. Okay, we have now an invisible toll booth in the Strait of Hormuz, the most important checkpoint on the planet. If you talk to the owner of the toll booth, we can grant you safe passage. We Chinese don't even have to talk because they already had a deal before the Iranians installed the toll booth. Everybody else, we need to talk. And if you are linked to U.S., Israeli, or hostile interests, forget it. You won't cross. That explains why we have over 700 LNG tankers in the Strait of Hormuz on both sides as we speak. And soon it's going to be 800, 900, 1,000, right? Very, very important. They didn't start that from the beginning. The beginning was, okay, we need to wear down the, we can call it Epstein Syndicate military machine, which is exactly what they did. Let's see, the first week till half of the second week of the war. Old missiles made in 2012, 13, 14, old drones, not the latest Shahids, which are now reversed from Russia. It's fantastic. The Shahids that they are using in Iran are the Jaran 5 and 6, with comet antennas, which the Russians improved in Russia. Now they are back in Iran. Fascinating. That's where we are now. And of course, we didn't have the latest generation missiles, which they started to launch only a few days ago, including Khorramshahr 4. So after all that was in place and their counterpunch was up and running, they start thinking about a financial bomb. And for that, you don't need a nuclear bomb. You just need a financial bomb. Okay, our toll booth in the Strait of Hormuz. Because they know this will, in the, I would say, midterm, collapse the global economy, period. It's a discussion that many of us were having in the past decade already with Goldman Sachs analysts, guys at Goldman Sachs that were specialists in derivatives. When Zoltan Poznar was still with Credit Suisse, he was writing about this all the time. And he was saying, look, it's not going to be a barrel of oil for 100, 150, 200. It can get to 500. And the Goldman Sachs guys were saying, no, it can get to 700 after a few weeks. We are getting to 150, maybe in the next 2 days, 200. So this is the exact moment that Iran chooses to install the toll booths and said, okay, this is the beginning of the end of the petrodollar, and we started it. Super, super, super question, and I'm sure many of you will ask, was this concerted with China? There's no evidence, and we will never have an official confirmation in Tehran or in Beijing. But of course, they discuss this as the highest level, because this is part of Chinese policy for the rest of the century. This is what they talk about in BRICS Business Council meetings, during the BRICS summits, during the preparations for the BRICS. But now, because Iran already trades oil and gas with China through the SIPS Chinese system, China International Paying System, it's very, very easy. And now, not only they have the model, but they can also advertise to the Global South, look what we do. We abandon the petrodollar, we use the petro-yuan, we pay through SIPS, and all of you can do the same thing. And with a practical demonstration in the most important choke point on the planet. So this is a financial nuclear bomb, essentially.
On that topic, there's a very interesting Financial Times article out today, which is talking about the situation in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. They're desperately short of energy there.
Yes.
In Indian restaurants, they're no longer using gas to fry. And they can't use gas in crematoria. The Prime Minister of Pakistan is talking about an absolute crisis. The Prime Minister of Bangladesh is saying that they've had to switch off the air conditioning in his office because they are running out of energy. And I've heard that in Southeast Asia, this is also now cumulatively happening as well.
Even so here in Thailand. Yes.
Yeah. So we are to some extent still a bit insulated in the West from this. So far, we only see it in higher prices, but elsewhere in the world, it is already, this bomb, as you describe it, is detonating, and it is detonating loudly, and the echo effect of this is going to increase, and it is going to increase all the time. Now, Pepe, you've been to Iran, you've visited the country, you've seen the people. Now, this is the big question that we always ask ourselves, and which we are always asked, how stable is it? Because it's quite clear to me, it's been quite clear to us, that the real, the underlying plan was to kill off the chief leaders, expect the country to crash. The assumption was that the government there was very unpopular. What is the reality? What was your impression anyway of Iran?
Well, I was very privileged, Alex, this past May last year, when we were shooting the documentary. We were in Tehran, in Qom, in Isfahan, in the Persian Gulf, in Bandar Abbas, the main port, in Chabahar, in the Gulf of Oman. I was traveling. This was a dream that I had as a reporter. I always wanted to go to Sistan, Baluchistan province. And they always told me, no, it's too dangerous. We cannot allow a foreigner to go there. So this time, finally. And when you get there and you meet with the Sistanis and the Baluchis, one of the most hospitable people on the planet. And they are thinking about, you know, our province soon is going to be booming because of Chabahar Port. Chabahar Port was going to play a role similar to Shenzhen in Guangdong province, you know, 30-something, 40 years ago. And they're very optimistic. And they say, look, okay, those crazies from the Pakistani Baluchi side, Baluchistan Liberation Movement, they do back and forth. They come here, they shoot some people and all that, but it's a minority, it's fringe, it's under control. So I had the privilege to go to most of Iran from north to south and not only be confined to North Tehran. When you are in North Tehran, it's like you are in, I don't know, in Mayfair in London. You don't see the real London, you see? Yeah. It's the same thing. And in the provinces, all over, there is steady support for the Islamic Revolution still, even though there is serious criticism about how they run the economy. And this proceeds. It's absolutely correct. For instance, those protests that later were instrumentalized by CIA, NED, etc., they were legitimate because the cost of living went, completely crazy. Like $1 became over 1 million reals. Completely absurd. What did the government do at the time? And this is something you won't see in Western media. They called the bazaaris. It's still a bazaar economy in many aspects, Iran, everywhere. They call the bazaar and say, okay, what are the problems? Let's see if we can solve it. Okay, we can start giving a small bonus to people, which at the time amounted to $7 or $8, but in terms of millions of reals made a difference. So there were negotiations between traders, merchants, bazaaris, and the government. And then the whole thing derailed because the protests were instrumentalized. Well, apart from mismanaging the economy, for a country that is under sanctions for 47 years, and when you see in front of you instances of that, for instance, I was visiting the port of Bandar Azali in the Caspian. So I got there and say, where is the port? They say, it's here. I say, you must be joking. There was nothing. The infrastructure was like maybe a small port in southern Africa, maximum. There was nothing. And then you see the effects of sanctions in front of you. Minimal infrastructure and no infrastructure upgrading. You can even see that in parts of Tehran itself, you know, especially South Tehran, which is a more working class, an enormous working class neighborhood. But when people, they don't criticize the fundamentals of the Islamic Revolution. They criticize specifically a few ayatollahs, right? But not the whole system. They criticize economic mismanagement, but they understand that the system as a whole, it's faithful to the initial idea, which was a mix of Shiite theology and anti-colonialism. The basis of the Islamic Revolution in 78, that's what it was. Okay, there were many problems afterwards. We can spend days talking about that. But people instinctively understand that this, even with there are corruption problems, obviously, but instinctively they understand that this is a system that is worried with the welfare of as many Iranians as possible. And they know the alternative. For instance, the MEK, nobody has pledged allegiance to the MEK inside Iran. This clownish exiled in Maryland Shah, wow, he's beyond despised by everybody. So there is no political alternative. And as we know, the Communist Party was decimated. But we still have wonderful Marxist theoreticians. And the most incredible thing, because they have some of the best universities in the world, you meet people, for instance, who are well-versed in Kant and Nietzsche compared to Shiite theology.
Yeah.
Wow. So the level is up there. When you compare the level of Araxi, Kalibaf, these guys who are at the top of the government now with the American counterparts, well, you can, you know, there's absolutely no comparison. So, you know, it's, and of course they understand that they are surrounded by the Americans everywhere. And the only thing that the Americans want is to destroy Iran. And this is a consensus from the old aristocracy and the elite, urban elites, not only in Tehran, Shiraz, not to mention, of course, Qom, with there are different levels of experts in Shiism. For instance, years ago, I was trying to interview the ultra-hardcore Ayatollah in Qom. He did not receive me because I was a foreigner. But over the years, I managed to interview three or four Ayatollahs that are considered moderate and very, very progressive. You know, they are within the strict limits of Shiite theology, but they look around and they understand the rest of the Islamic world, even though they are Sunnis or Sufis, whatever. So it's an incredibly creative, dynamic, very well-educated society. You get to the best universities in Tehran. Most of the students are girls, extremely well-prepared. Last time I was there, I had a debate in one of the top universities. Most of the audience were PhD girls, and the best questions came from the girls. Anything about that? Yes, please go ahead.
I thank you for saying all of that, because I think this is something many, many people do not understand, that this is actually now a very, very educated society. I remember when I was young, I never went mm-hmm. to Iran, but in Greece we had many contacts with Iran. That was not true then. Then it was not educated. Today, emphatically, it is. And that has mm-hmm. been something that has changed radically since 1979, since the revolution. Do the Americans have any understanding of this? Do the Americans understand the kind of society that they're up against? Or do they see things entirely in terms of transportation corridors and BRICS connections and those sort of things? In other words, do the Americans have an understanding of the psychology, the temperament, the texture of the society that they're taking on, or do they see it purely in geostrategic terms?
It's a very good question, Alex, because it comes back to our old friend Lévi-Strauss, which obviously nobody reads Lévi-Strauss in American universities, not to mention those sycophants, vassals, and idiots who are part of the Trump administration. It's the concept of understanding the other and interacting with the other. For American exceptionalism, the other, by definition, is inferior. That applied to the demonization of Iraq before shock and awe in 2003. That applied to Libyans. That applied to Syrians. That applies to Lebanese. And that applies to Iranians as well. Not to mention, of course, everybody else, Russians, Chinese, Latin Americans, blacks, etc. It's one of the key characteristics of the empire. And they will never get rid of it. You know, the mix of exceptionalism, manifest destiny, and everybody else is inferior. It's all interconnected. It's I would say, the essence of U.S. foreign policy, for that matter. You remember in Vietnam, there were rice-eating rats. And you see what the rats did to the greatest military machine in the history of the universe. The same thing with that. They didn't. Obviously, they couldn't do their homework before. And, of course, they were, of course, the rhetoric came from Israel full-time. Israel humanizes virtually the whole planet. For these fanatics in Israel, the whole planet is Amalek, literally. And they behave like that. So we're talking about two immensely destructive, violent regimes, the American Israeli. They cannot possibly understand a very complex, educated society like Iran. More than that, with 2,500, nearly 3,000 years of history. It's impossible, because they are in the process of annihilating history, annihilating culture, annihilating interaction. and only their completely warped view of total dominance prevails.
Yeah.
It's a cultural war as well.
Yeah. Do the Americans have a plan? I mean, I got the sense at the beginning that they did, that the plan was kill the supreme leader, kill the top officials. They perhaps had some ideas of some people stepping in and taking the place of the supreme leader and mm-hmm. doing what is supposed to have happened in Venezuela. That clearly hasn't happened. Do they have a plan now? I read a very, very alarming piece recently about mm-hmm. some comments made by General Kane, which was basically destroy everything. just go on bombing and destroy all the infrastructure, all the industry, everything. Is that actually the plan? I mean, that would take years.
Apparently, decades. Now, Alex.
Yes.
Considering that Plan A didn't work, and Plan A was... okay, he's throwing everybody under the bus, but what all these psychophants were telling him, with a few others, like Stephen Miller, for instance, is, yeah, it's very easy. You go there, decapitation strike, maybe a beginning of the weekend, there's going to be regime change. On Monday, the markets reopen, up and up. You do your mission accomplished, and that's it, you know, another scalp for you. Obviously, coming from these people who don't know anything about Iran, obviously backfired. And with the difference, unlike the 12-day war, now there's no room for compromise, ceasefire, capitulation, whatever. And it's fascinating to hear, especially Araghchi every day. Araghchi now is finally coming, he's coming out as a real hardcore diplomat. He's saying, look, why? We were on the negotiating table and we were bombed. What ceasefire? What diplomacy? They don't believe in diplomacy. And we don't want war. We want to make sure that we conduct this war in a way that they will never try to do this against us again. And that brings us to I qualified as the eviction notice in one of my columns last week. And now it's being ratified. There's an article on Tasnim, a news agency today, which basically ratifies what was not fully documented before. Their list to the Americans. If you don't follow their list, the war continues. And that includes a lot of stuff, especially the eviction notice. No more U.S. bases in West Asia. No more sanctions.
Can you tell us what that list is? Because this has not been widely reported here in Britain. I suspect it's not been very widely reported.
You don't read the comma about this in Western mainstream media.
No, exactly. So can you tell us what the list is?
Yeah. This came last week. Originally, it was from the IRGC command. Then it two or three days later, no, these come directly from Mojtaba Khamenei. And then, of course, diplomatically, they were not saying anything. But the leak was all across Iranian media. And now the Tasnim News Agency publishes as a fait accompli, and the list is there. And the list, obviously, the list was not delivered to the Americans, but the proverbial middleman like Oman passed this to the Americans, obviously. It's it originally had 9 points, including a solution for Palestine, a Palestinian state, the end of the genocide and a Palestinian state. But now the three main points which are being reiterated today are no more bases in West Asia, end of U.S. military bases, end of sanctions, payment of reparations, and very, very important, Iran is allowed to continue with this civilian nuclear program with no monitoring from anybody, especially that ghastly Rafael Grossi. Can you imagine the Trump administration? Oh, we know that. And obviously, but they had to issue the order. So the order now is public. And this means that the war will continue. This was also their way of saying the war will continue until we meet our terms. And these terms are non-negotiable. So in fact, the capitulation now is in reverse. They basically want the United States to capitulate in West Asia as a whole. That's how big it is. And no wonder, Alex, just not a line about this in Western mainstream media. No.
It is, in fact, what is demanded, what is being, the conditions are an almost revolutionary document in themselves. I mean, you spoke about decolonization and Iran being about decolonization, and anybody who's familiar with Iranian history would understand why that stream in Iranian history is very strong. But if this is executed, then it is the end of the Western presence in the Middle East, which has been there since the early 19th century, since Napoleon Bonaparte, in effect. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it is an extraordinary, extraordinary moment. Do they have the willpower to see it through?
Yes, they do. And this is something that, okay, many of us who follow Iran, who go to Iran frequently, in the first few days, we said, how long can they last? After we see what they are saying in public, what are the leaks in private here and there, their actions, how they are tweaking their, in fact, brilliant decentralized mosaic strategy, which is basically 31 commanders in 31 different provinces with the leeway to make decisions in a matter of a second or two without having to pick up the phone and call Central Command in Tehran. So it's completely decentralized, and they have all the equipment that they need, especially the unseen equipment, which none of us have seen yet, because they are mostly in eastern Iran. They are, I would say, in Sistan Baluchistan in the southeast. They are near the Afghan border to the east. So, and all these areas have not been bombed by the Americans yet. The Americans don't even know what is there. And the bulk of the new weaponry, especially the new missiles, plus, I would say, a forest of drones everywhere, they're all there. So when you put this all together and you see the strategy, how it was meticulously planned, by the way, we had confirmation by Ayatollah Khamenei himself. He supervised the battle plan after the 12-day war, personally, including four layers of how people should be replaced in case they were assassinated, which is exactly what happened in the decapitation strike on February 28th in the morning. He even had a list of people who should replace him. Apparently, and of course, this is not confirmed, his own son was not on the list. He didn't want to have this feeling of we have a dynasty. He was very much contrary to it. So essentially, Mojtaba Khamenei was the IRGC candidate. And because the IRGC took over immediately after the decapitation strike, and now the IRGC is in fact running everything, they could, how can I put this diplomatically? I wouldn't say pressure, but they could explain to the assembly of experts why Mojtaba Khamenei, as a symbolic figure, would be more important than any other more qualified Ayatollah that they might choose. And so obviously they were successful. Because when you look at zillions of people hitting every square in Iran immediately after the announcement of Mojtaba's new supreme leader to pledge their allegiance, he had not appeared in public. Nobody knew if he was dead or alive or if he was seriously injured. Apparently, he was seriously injured. He had not made a single pronouncement live. So people were pledged allegiance to an idea, a flaming idea, a symbol. That in itself is extremely impressive. Because now they could see, okay, the legacy of the father is being preserved by the son. Even if we don't even need to see him, we know that he's going to be there for his father, for the legacy of his father. And of course, the death of Khamenei as a martyr, in terms of Shiite theology, you cannot go higher than that. He died like Imam Ali and Hussein. You cannot go higher than that. So that unified the whole country even more. That unified the Shiite world, over 300 million people all over, the Shiite diaspora everywhere. And that extrapolated to a great deal of the Sunni world as well. Like Mojtaba Khamenei is already a big star among a great deal of 2 billion Muslims everywhere as a symbol of resistance. There you go.
There you go. On that, very quickly, there is a rumor circulating this morning in the Arab media that he's in Moscow in a hospital receiving treatment there. Peskov, Putin's spokesman, was asked by it, and he said that he wouldn't confirm or deny. He said, "We don't comment on these matters."
Exactly. So, this is we know Peskov. This is typical Peskov. He's
absolutely,
always hedging.
Absolutely.
But if this was true, you know, many of our friends who are former officials or former intelligence apparatus, diplomats, heads of think tanks in Moscow, they would know. And this information would be circulating everywhere. For the moment, nothing. I don't think this is true. And when you say Arab media, Alex, if it's all just...
Kuwaiti media, to be precise.
Well, you cannot trust these people. They lie all the time.
True enough. Anyway, let's talk about something else, because you mentioned that they want to have the right to enrich uranium and to do it by themselves without the supervision from Rafael Grossi at the IAEA, and I completely understand why after what's repeatedly happened. But this brings us back to this question of Iran wanting to acquire nuclear weapons, because when people are asked, when you talk to people about Iran, we don't know much about the country, it's one of the things that always comes up. Is Iran interested in acquiring nuclear weapons? Is that at the back of their minds? If it is, why haven't they done it in 30 years? Because they certainly could have. But I mean, what is the story? What is the story about Iran and nuclear weapons? What is this all really about?
Well, first of all, the first Khomeini fatwa. Iran cannot have nuclear weapons because it's anti-Islamic and it kills brothers and sisters of Islamic faith and other faiths as well. This was reiterated by another fatwa by Khamenei many years later. Same thing. So the main block in terms of the political and religious leader of Iran against Iran building a nuclear bomb came directly from Khamenei and a few other ayatollahs in Qom. Now, not anymore. So all bets are off. And considering that the IRGC now is running everything, and consider that Mojtaba was chosen especially because he was, I wouldn't say the go-between, but the main channel between Khamenei and the IRGC leadership was via Mojtaba. So he knows all the leadership, the decapitated, the people who are running the show now, the replacements, etc., very, very, very well. And they trust him. So there is a very strong possibility that we can have this announcement, I would say maybe midterm, because they know that would be the only way to, in terms of dissuasion, there is nothing else. Although they don't need a nuclear bomb. With what they have in terms of how they turn the war upside down with drones and their enormous range of missiles. And what they learned from the Russians, very, very important, how to coordinate drone swarms and missile volleys. They learned this from the Russians.
Yeah.
This was strategic partnership Russia-Iran, the highest level, Ministry of Defense style. They don't need nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. They can destroy Israel with what they have already. And they can destroy all those U.S. military bases, which, by the way, different numbers. Between 70 and 80% of all those bases are already destroyed. Yeah. They don't need a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. Let's talk about Israel, because, again, the other thing people always talk about with Iran is that it is out to destroy Israel and that this is its objective. But you say that they're now talking instead about something quite different, or at least apparently different, which is about having a Palestinian state. Now, that suggests that they're actually looking for a negotiated solution. What is it that they really want, and what is the rhetoric about this in Iran itself?
At the moment, they are not getting to details because they are in the middle of a war.
Yeah.
If we go back 2-3 weeks before the decapitation strike, their position has not changed. Mm-hmm. End of the genocide, for obvious reasons. The whole planet, not only the Arab world and the global south, but the whole planet, including the United Nations, recognizing the immediate necessity of proclaiming a Palestinian state. And, of course, start negotiating the modalities of how this state would come to be. If we look at the devastation and the unspeakable horrors detonated over Gaza and now going to parts of the West Bank, there's no rational possibility of having a state. You have to start from scratch. And obviously, it's not going to be the Board of Peace by those absolutely ghastly elements, including, by the way, financed by the Gulf. Yeah. Most of the money for the Board of Peace comes from the Emirates, in fact, which the business model of the Emirates, if we look at it now, it's already dead. Yeah. Dubai, as a business model, is already dead. And Abu Dhabi could be dead if they stop exporting oil. So it's fascinating. You have Iraqi scholars already theorizing that sooner or later, the UAE is going to be re-annexed to Oman, which is not absurd. It could happen. No. If they are totally, left in the dust, the only possibility for them is to go back to Oman. They were part of Oman before.
Yeah.
So the problem is there is no way in heaven or hell that Israel and the United States will be convinced, even if it's by the whole planet, of starting negotiations leading towards a Palestinian state and rebuilding a Palestinian state. We all know that. We are realists. We work with facts. And the facts don't point to this direction, unfortunately.
Let's go back to the oil crisis.
Sure.
The Iranians closed. Well, they haven't closed. They've established what you, I think it's a brilliant comment, by the way, called this toll booth. Which I think is a brilliant way to describe it, by the way. So they've established this toll booth on the Gulf of Hormuz. Strait of Hormuz. One gets the sense that the Americans completely did not expect this possibility, which I find incredible, by the way, but apparently it was something that was not there in their planning. It's not at all clear what they can do. I've discussed this with various people who are military backgrounds, forcing passage into the Strait of Hormuz, incredibly dangerous. Seizing Hatay, so dangerous that it's probably impractical. These things the US Navy doesn't want to do, the European navies don't want to do. If they ask the Chinese to do it, then you know that they're desperate, and they've asked the Chinese to do it, Trump has. So they're not going to do that. What are they going to do in this situation? Because this does have a cumulative effect on the US economy, as well as the wider global economy as well. Will they continue escalation, or will they instead try to find some way to end this crisis, which, given all that you've been saying about the mood in Iran at the moment and the objective that the Iranians have, may be extremely difficult. What do you think that the Americans are going to do? Because you've come across the Americans in many places, many times. You've seen what they do. You have a sense of what they think. What are your thoughts about this, Ben?
Let's backtrack a little bit to that famous phone call placed by Trump to Putin. When you read, when you see the readout by the Kremlin, it doesn't say much. But then Ushakov made a few comments. Usually he talks to a few of the main Russian channels. And it's absolutely fascinating. As you know, Ushakov is an old fox, immensely smart, and he prefers to be quite laconic most of the time. Basically, he was saying that Trump was desperate and he was asking for help. This is what you read between the lines. And Putin said, I might, if I, okay, let me try to be the mediator. I'm willing to be a mediator between you and Iran. But that's something very important. The Iranians have to accept it. Can you imagine Trump listening to it? But it's not, he's not the decider. Now the card, literally the cards are with Iran. And Iran doesn't want any diplomacy. So there's no way out for him. He cannot, even if he declares victory tomorrow, does a mission accomplished on board a ship somewhere, Iran will continue. Because the number one objective for them is expulsion of the U.S. from West Asia as a whole. Once they have that, they might negotiate on the other, if it was 9 points in the beginning, the other 8 points. But this is point number one. Right. So, and because once again, with that circle of absolute idiots around Trump, incapable of planning how to order a pizza, and they start a war like that without a plan B or C, or listening to their generals, or listening to their good CIA analysts who understand the region as well, what are they going to do? What we have now. This endless rambling vociferation on Truth social posts. We read them and, okay, but what does that mean? Nobody knows what it means. And where is it leading to? Is there any thought process behind it? Is there any possibility of at least submitting it to public opinion or starting on the diplomatic process? Nothing, nothing. It's just pure rage and impotence distilled in posts. A president that, you know, exercises his imperial power by posts on social media. It's pathetic, but that's what it is. Well, he killed American foreign policy. There are excellent diplomats in the U.S., as we know, all marginalized. Our friends, old CIA analysts, etc., they all saying this is beyond crazy. And there's no turning back, and there's no solution, and there's no off-ramp.
Yeah.
Because Iran blocked the off-ramp. Yeah. And now, with the toll booth in action in the Strait of Hormuz, this could go on for a long time. Yeah. But then, Alex, I was reading this before starting a talk with you. Okay, we cannot trust anything coming from American media. They are discussing in Washington that this war could go on until September. September, the whole global economy will be in a black pit, the blackest of all black pits anywhere. It's absolutely impossible. And first of all, the Gulf won't survive. UAE may survive another, maximum another month under these conditions. Bahrain is already collapsing. Kuwait, the same. Qatar, probably, you know, they're going to go to Europe and ask refuge in London or Paris. After all, they own the half of London, the half of Paris. Mm-hmm. Completely absurd.
What is the risk of nuclear weapons being used? I've heard this discussed. I've heard people talk about this. We both know that it was discussed during the Vietnam War.
Of course,
so
it
it's
was.
It's not as if this is something that has never happened before. What is the risk of it?
Terrifying, Alex. Terrifying because it's on the table. Mm-hmm. This mere fact is already terrifying in itself. Mm-hmm. And probably the greatest danger is those fanatics in Tel Aviv, if they feel they're ultimately cornered and Israel is being devastated. Probably much more dangerous than an American presidency.
Yeah.
There will be people in Washington, they'll be ready to do anything to block a decision like that coming from Trump, but not in Tel Aviv, as we know.
Last question. How long do you think this war is going to go on for? I mean, because the way you describe it, it does look like a long war. But
yes.
What does that mean? Are we looking at, is a long war weeks? In the West, we think of wars, long wars. A war that lasts more than a couple of days is a long war for us. We're very different from the Russians here, for whom wars... A four-year war is not a long war in Russia, but a four-week war is a very long war in the West. How long is it going to continue for?
Remember the start of the SMO, Alex, when everybody was saying, this is going to last a few weeks, even before Istanbul.
Yeah.
And if Istanbul worked, Istanbul was in April, right? It would have lasted a few weeks. In fact, it was practically that deal was practically clinched in Istanbul. It was according to the Turks, they told us, "Look, it's 90%. We're going to clinch it in the next few hours. 4 years and running, and it's not going to be decided in 2026. So the war in Ukraine will have at least a year, if not two, ahead. So what can we say about this war? Because this war now is really convulsing the whole global economy, not the proxy war in Ukraine. This is much more serious. And it involves turning the whole international system upside down, literally, with some countries even disappearing from the map or being annexed by others. And, of course, the geoeconomic effects and financial effects everywhere, nobody knows. I remember when these Goldman Sachs guys were talking about the collapse of the global economy. They said, "But look, but we cannot even we don't even have models to study how it would collapse. It could be in one go. It could be a total paralysis. And now we are watching it in front of us, with oil between 100, soon 150, soon 200, and then it keeps going. And the Iranians say, the war lasts as long as our targets are not met. And they mean it. And they are backing it up with, which one is now, as we speak, 55 or 60, 55, 68 battery of... missile volley, part of Operation True Promise 4. And we'll keep going. 100, 150, 200. And at the same time, they know that checkmate, né, which, by the way, is a Persian expression, as we all know. Shahmat.
Absolutely.
Shahmat means the king cannot go anywhere. So this is a shahmat.
Absolutely. On that... Pepe Escobar, I'm going to stop. Thank you as always for your
Thank you so much.
To my questions. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
I think that taught an awful lot to people who perhaps are still wondering about many of the things that are going on in this war. And just one very quick point. Russians, Iranians, very similar in some things, very different in many things, but neither
it's
will
true.
Accept a temporary ceasefire. Temporary ceasefires are not something we are interested in, and all our objectives must be achieved. The Russians say that about the Ukraine war. The Iranians are saying
yes.
It about this war too. Anyway, with that...
You know why, Alex? Because they're both sovereign nations.
They're sovereign nations.
That's the answer.
Indeed. Absolutely. Pepe, thank you very much, and let's absolutely
thank
have you.
Thank you, Alex.
if you could just stay a few minutes, Alex.
Yes. Yeah, of course.
We got many interesting questions and comments for Pepe from JJHW. I'd just like to thank Pepe for everything he does. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks.
Thank you for that. From Flight of Arrow, America is on the way to great isolation. Okay.
Yes, but they don't care if they are isolated. Huh?
Yeah.
They don't care.
From Matthew, Pepe, will Trump pull out before the severe economic impacts occur?
If the donors and ruling elites pick up the phone and tell him to do it, he'll have to do it. Don't forget, he's not Julius Caesar. Huh? Not to mention Tiberius, Crassus, Caligula. There are people behind him.
Good point. From Nancy, thanks for having Pepe on the Duran Rocks. Thank you for that, Nancy. From Nino, what would the repercussions be for Israel or the U.S. if one of them uses a nuke? Would it just be other countries just condemning it and back to business as usual, or will there be actual repercussions?
Well, there will be a lot of repercussions because this is the absolute no rules new paradigm. We have been living in this new paradigm. It used to be, as you all know, rules-based international order. And for the last year and 3 months is no rules whatsoever, international chaos. But this is beyond anything. This is, Nagasaki, okay, that was just a start. Nobody can process that, you know. It will take a long time for all of us to start processing it. Not to mention governments everywhere, you know.
Yeah, very true. From Nikos, Mr. Pepe, can you tell my fellow Greeks that India betrayed BRICS? The multipolar
world. Yes, they did.
They did. Okay. The multipolar world is dead because the U.S. beat it into submission. Cuba has fallen. And part two is China is still giving the U.S. the resources to make weapons when they could have supported Russia and stopped. Modi treated his country like a vassal.
Absolutely. On China is much more complicated. I'm not sure we're going to have time to talk about what China is playing. I think I gave you, all of you, a hint of how they are playing the chessboard with the Iranian move to install the toll booth. But my column about that is coming out tomorrow on the Cradle in Beirut. So if you have a chance, all of you, please read it, because I make a comparison and I make a comparison between chess and Go, and I try to explain briefly how China has been playing Go for quite a long time. And this is the definitive moment. And now they have the moment handed on a plate for them by Iran. But India, I am very sorry to say, I have been following BRICS closely for a long time. In 2024, I spent 6 months in Russia, mostly to follow the Russians, how they were organizing the summit in Kazan. So I know it's following BRICS is part of my life. And I am very sorry to admit to all of you that for the moment, BRICS is in a deep coma. And I have no idea how it's going to be resurrected. So I wonder the BRICS. I haven't talked to BRICS Sherpas these past few weeks for obvious reasons. So next time I meet BRICS Sherpas in Moscow, the first question is, how are you going to resurrect BRICS? And the only ones who could do are the Russian BRICS Sherpas, and they are the best, led by Sergei Ryabkov, number two at the foreign ministry, one of the best diplomats in the world. These are the only people who could try to resurrect BRICS. But BRICS is in a coma because of India now, unfortunately.
My M2X says the Duran is bringing out the best in Pepe.
come on.
He doesn't need anything from us. He's
from Rumble, from Zim in Seattle. Thank you so much for having Pepe on. I've been following him for at least 20 years. The three of you together is indeed a geopolitical blockbuster. Thank you for that, Zim. From the Eurasianist on Locals, the size of Iran's economy, Pepe, as well as its trade volume with Russia and China, is tiny compared to its potential. Due to the U.S. sanctions, Iran's importance is currently more strategic than economic. Iran's resistance blocks the U.S. from controlling global energy flows and from gaining a foothold in the Eurasian heartland. That's why Iran matters to Russia and China. Your thoughts, Pepe?
Yes, because they are the third key pole. It's not Turkey, it's not Pakistan, it's not India, it's Iran. Until a few months ago, many of us were discussing that the RIC, the original Primakov triangle. Primakov was the guy who conceptualized the pre-BRICS era, and in fact, BRICS was Russia, India, China. And he was theorizing that in the late 90s. Way before BRICS was created. BRICS started in 2001. And we start talking about, okay, now it's the new RIC, the revamped Primakov triangle with Iran instead of India. Then India made a few moves. They were getting closer to Russia, etc., until they betrayed Russia once again. And now they betrayed Russia and Iran. So, in fact, the new Primakov triangle is, for all practical purposes, Russia, Iran, and China. The problem is Iran, as the weaker node, has to be protected by both. And they are, diplomatically, politically, not directly economically, but militarily, very, very important. Many of us have written about it, how Russia is helping, you know, intelligence, satellites, drones, and China, same thing, intelligence, satellites, Beidou, you name it. They know that Iran cannot fall. If Iran falls, this process of Eurasia integration collapses because the central node in Eurasia is Iran. And when you are in Iran, when you travel in Iran, when you see how it's in the center of all these interconnecting nodes, and even this corridor itself, which is a brilliant idea, instead of east to west, is north to south. Bypassing Suez completely, bypassing the Americans, bypassing trading in dollars, and uniting three BRICS until India bombed it. But it doesn't matter. I'll give you an example, guys. I was in the port of Chabahar. That's in the Gulf of Oman, near the Iran-Pakistani border, very close. And I was talking to the head of the port, special economic zone, etc. And they were showing me, you see Indian investments everywhere, these cranes, etc. And then I noticed two Chinese cargoes. And then I asked him, look, the Chinese cargoes are coming here because they usually go to Bandar Abbas. And I said, no, they start to use our port as well. So then we start talking, and I told him, look, maybe this corridor soon could become Russia, Iran, China. And he said, we are ready for it. We will welcome it. There you go. He opened up the next stage of the game. The Chinese are going to look at the map and say, look, we have already a base in Gwadar in Pakistan. It's about, I think it's 300 kilometers from one port to another. One in the Arabian Sea, one in the Sea of Oman. So why not have two? So India, once again, they shot themselves in the back. It's unbelievable.
From Zariel, and thank you, Zariel, for putting all of this together as well. So a big shout out to Zariel. Pepe, Alex, or Alexander, what information do you have on Netanyahu's health? Are the rumors true?
Nobody knows anything, literally. It's fascinating because the latest video with the cup of coffee, there are zillions of people on the net pointing to all the absurdities in the video. So nobody knows for sure.
Very true.
He's been very, if he's all right, then he's been very, very, very quiet recently.
Yeah.
Which is interesting fact in itself.
Speak to the media. Go on, meet the press.
Exactly.
So it just obviously raises alarms, though. Of course.
Very true. Fantastic. Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for answering questions as well.
Thank,
And please come again. We'll have it again, please.
Absolutely. Let's do it again. Once again, all of the links, Pepe's books, the links to his articles, I will add them in the description box as well as a pinned comment when the
live. And please watch the documentary.
We will watch the documentary as well.
I think this documentary can be very helpful for all of you to understand what Iran is doing. Seriously.
And I will certainly be reading this article in The Cradle tomorrow.
Yes, it's probably coming out tomorrow because they have to translate to Turkish and Arabic before publishing. You know, it takes a while.
So definitely look out for that article as well. Pepe, thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
Take care.
And as we used to say in Latin America in the 60s, the struggle continues.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Thank you so much, Pepe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers. Bye bye.
Bye.
Alexander, you out there?
Absolutely, I am. I'm still here.
All right. fantastic stream.
Yes.
Great interview. Great answers. Let's go to the remaining questions.
Yeah.
All right. Let's start things off with Nikos. Mm. This is a three part question, Alexander. Levan had a heated reaction yesterday about the Ukrainian drone strikes that said that Russia is humiliated and the whole world is laughing at them. Why is Russia humiliated? Because they aren't behaving like animals, because they don't want a nuclear war. Was it Russia's fault that Cuba fell? My cousin is full-blown communist and he adores Castro. He is ashamed of this new president. Russia is the country that tried the most to help.
Well, I don't know that Cuba has yet fallen. I mean, you're ahead of the news. Where I'm concerned, it is extraordinary that Cuba continues to prefer negotiations with the United States as opposed to accept help, because that's how I see it, help that's been offered. But there it is. But about the drone strikes and Levan's response to this, I'm just going to say this. I'm reading in the media today here in London about how the Russians supposedly are the great winners in the conflict in Iran, that their receipts from oil sales are surging, that Bart De Wever, the Belgian prime minister, says we've got to normalize relations with them. I read in the Financial Times about how apparently European states are making entreaties, that's their word, to the Russians to try and get the Russians to agree to include them in the negotiations over Ukraine. And I also reading in the Financial Times apparently about the shock the French experienced when Macron sent two envoys to Moscow and met Ushakov, and Ushakov basically told them to buzz off. Only he used a much stronger word than the one I'm prepared to do. So all I'm saying is I don't get the sense that around the world people see Russia as humiliated. Just a sec.
From Zariel, we missed this Zariel before Pepe left. Pepe, what are your thoughts on Israel threatening Turkey? Iran is important, but so is Turkey.
Well, it is important. And I have to say that to threaten Turkey, even as Iran, you haven't sorted out your problems with Iran, which are growing worse, seems to me, I mean, not just irrational, but at the farthest end of irrational. It shows a country or a political system in Israel which is losing its connection to reality.
From the Eurasianist, Trump has plans to attack Cuba Venezuela style by decapitating its leadership. Do you think this extended quagmire with Iran could work in Cuba's favor, or will the oil blockade take its toll on Cuba?
Well, I think it will take its toll on Cuba. I think the Cubans need to make decisions about what they're going to do and how they're going to deal with this problem. I'd be in contact with people who are there. They tell me that the mood in Cuba is grim, but that overall people do want to, you know, stand firm in the face of all of this. Many of them, again, as we heard with Pepe talking about Iran, many of them have many, many criticisms to make about the political system in Cuba. Many people would like to see Cuba change, but they don't trust people like Rubio and people like that to do it for them. So I think a government in Havana that had more understanding of its options and more willingness to use the cards it has would be in a stronger position than the one we see at the moment.
Zariel says, once nukes are used, it's way over the Rubicon. The nukes today are much larger than Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Absolutely. I mean, we are in a completely different world. It is BC AD in terms of international relations.
Eurasianist says, I don't expect much from BRICS in 2026 because India, which is presiding BRICS this year, does not want to irk Trump. But what really matters is the China-Russia axis. BRICS without China and Russia is like NATO without the U.S. China's Belt and Road is the real backbone of BRICS economic cooperation.
I am more optimistic about BRICS than Pepe is, perhaps because I have less personally invested in it. I think the show will stay on the road. I agree with you completely that the core of BRICS is and always has been the Russian-Chinese strategic partnership. I think that India's policies are more sophisticated than I think people understand. And I don't think that India has broken with BRICS or plans to do so.
Nikos, three-part question. The West knows how to use media. They are still trying to destroy the 2023 President Putin's image of protecting Russia. The Russians are so bad at this. Do you believe that it's a weakness for Russia not to respond to European countries? To European countries like the U.S., we are horrified with what the West is doing. I put on X about the Greek ship that was attacked, saying that we shouldn't care because we betrayed Russia, and Greeks and Greek users applauded me.
Well, the short answer is that you mustn't expect the Russians to behave like Americans, because Russians aren't Americans. I mean, acting in some of the ways that we see the U.S. doing would for Russia be acting totally out of character. And I can tell you for an absolute fact that the moment people start to try to behave out of character is when they start to make big, major, massive mistakes. So that's the first thing I would say about that. Yes, the Russians perhaps have shown more restraint than might have been to their advantage over the course of this conflict. More and more people in Moscow are saying this. And yes, the Russians are at a crippling disadvantage in the information war, which at many levels they don't take seriously, and where they basically say to themselves, we can never win, so why even try? But there is something I have to say, which is that I think in the West, we place far too much reliance upon our skill in the information war. We see this with the situation in Iran now. Everybody has been saying for 2 years, Iran is weak. Hezbollah in Lebanon was weak. It's a house of cards. The people are yearning to be free. All we need to do is to hit them, and the whole thing will come tumbling down. And it hasn't happened. And I've been reading the various people, especially in London, who've been advocating the attack on Iran. And you can see that they are bewildered by the fact that it hasn't happened. So the risk with information, relying too much information, on propaganda, is that you end up believing in it yourself and it starts to contaminate your decision making.
Very true, Alexander. But everything that's going on is AI anyway, according to
Trump. Well,
that's
true.
It's all AI.
Well, of course, absolutely. I mean, you know, nothing. All these missiles that are detonating.
The rallies.
They're just AI detonations.
The rallies are AI.
The rallies, exactly. It's all AI, yeah.
It's all AI. Matthew says, what are the practical implications for European economies?
They're bad. I mean, the European economies are in a dreadful state. and they're going to get worse. The United States is an oil producer and energy producer. It can do things because it is a producer and because it's self-sufficient in these things to cushion the blow, even though, even for the United States, this is going to cause major problems. But in Europe, we're already in crisis. We already have stagnation in many European economies. We are up to our ears in debt. And we are in the process of a major process of deindustrialization. This war is going to make the situation much, much worse. And in India, by the way, it's going to make it worse still. And that article in the Financial Times talked about this, and I've no doubt about that too.
Elena Diaz says, why doesn't the UN General Assembly activate the United for Peace vehicle for the Palestinians? The violence against Palestinians is awful and is a stain on humanity. Didn't the UN was created to prevent genocide?
Well, yes, it was. And the reason it's never happened, despite the fact that there's been many, many proposals that it would, is because the key Arab states have blocked it. I mean, they have always chosen in the end to work with the United States or to try to work with the United States rather than to confront the United States in that way. So the result is that there's never been a serious attempt to get a resolution of that kind activated, because without the Arab states, it can't be done.
Sif Casilvo, thank you for that super sticker. Blip blop zoop. Thank you for joining the Duran. Blip blop zoop says Iran is very neoliberal. Top economists praise Pinochet. Unless the grip of its oligarchy breaks, Iran's future after the war will be more of the same.
I think this is a massive overstatement, but I think that there is within the overstatement a significant amount of truth. In the sense that what I understand happened was that originally the Islamic Revolution basically had a conception of a very controlled economy in Iran. And then in the 1990s, the Iranian president of that time, Ayatollah Rafsanjani, began a whole set of policies to liberalize and open up the Iranian economy. And that did involve reintroducing into Iran many of the neoliberal and liberal ideas about how economics should be run. And I think this was unpopular with significant sections of Iranian society, including some of those sections of Iranian society which had previously supported the Islamic Republic. So I think that there is truth to this. I think this perhaps explains some of the economic problems, in the sense that maybe this model is not well adapted to Iranian conditions. And it also perhaps has created social tensions inside Iran and gulfs between the very rich and the poor and all of those things, which many people in Iran see as a betrayal of the original promise of the revolution. But I wouldn't say it is a neoliberal country. I think that's obviously going too far. If it was a neoliberal country, it wouldn't be attacked in the way that it is.
Harvard Dion says, isn't it likely that the U.S. wants the Great Reset?
Yeah. A great reset in relation to what? Iran? In relation to, well, general?
The great reset.
Is this the idea?
USD, the everything, the great reset.
Reset. Well, yeah. Some people in the United States might have some very grandiose plans. I mean, I don't think Donald Trump himself does, to be honest.
Yeah. Jerry Fox, thank you for that super sticker. From Nikos, two-part question. The Russian government got comfortable with the fact that all ships were returned up until March. Now the EU wants to make the seizures permanent. Right now, it's three ships seized. The window of response and countermeasures is manageable. They have to do something because there are no laws anymore.
Well, can I just say something? As I understand it, every ship that has been captured up to this time, or seized, perhaps is a better word than captured, up to this time, has been a ship which was not flying the Russian flag. The Russians have been saying for weeks to all ship owners, look, if you want to conduct trade with Russia, in order for us to protect you, you must register your ships on the Russian registry and fly the Russian flag. And this is a lot of the ship owners, for all kinds of very understandable reasons, have been very slow in doing this. I think in time you will find that more and more of them will, and that you're going to start to see the Russian merchant shipping register grow. And of course, at that point, Russian merchant ships are entitled to Russian protection and will start to get Russian naval escorts. But I think we're in this interim period between that situation and the one that is going to come.
Tapato Matato says, in this discussion of U.S. imperialism, perhaps it's appropriate to remember the My Lai massacre, which occurred 58 years ago today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Nico says, in my opinion, it's time for Zelensky, Budanov, and the Ukrainian leadership to go. It's the one option Russia has. No one will succeed Zelensky.
You mean decapitation strike? A decapitation strike. I am not sure that there is no one to succeed Zelensky, to be clear. I think that there would still be people. There'd be Timoshenko, there'd be Poroshenko, there'd be Klitschko. And I don't think that would necessarily solve the problem in Kiev, just saying.
J.M. Barbarossa says, what's the deal with Western journos saying Mojtaba Khamenei owns a shadow real estate empire in the UK? What is the argument and is it misinformation?
I'm pretty sure it is misinformation. I mean, I read every single day stories about Putin, that he owns half the world, that he has 500 Swiss watches, that he's dying of cancer, that he's senile.
Wouldn't the UK seize that real estate, Alexander, if that was
exactly,
the case?
Well, exactly. That's
like they've done with Russian sanctions and they've gone after everybody. And exactly, I mean, exactly. If all these people had all this property in the West,
exactly,
wouldn't they seize it?
Exactly. I mean, these are just stories that are planted with the reasons that we all know.
Elena Diaz says, can the soccer championship go on? Isn't it strange that nuclear weapons used is more plausible than soccer championship canceled?
That's a good point, yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if the World Cup, what happens with the World Cup, actually.
Well, it is. It'll be very interesting. It'll be very interesting to see if Trump goes to China, by the way. He's not talking about postponing the trip.
Because he doesn't have his Trump card.
Exactly.
Yeah. Xenophon Grigoriadis, thank you for that super sticker. From Nikos, Vucic claims Croatia, Albania, and Kosovo will attack Serbia. Finland is trying to pass a law to host nukes. What are the consequences of both these events?
Well, they're both escalating. Yeah, I mean, if there is an attack on Serbia, it's a massive escalation. By the way, I think if that happens, the Serbian military would cope with it, actually. And I think that would be another crisis in Europe. And I don't think at this moment in time, the EU is organized to deal with that kind of crisis. That's the first thing to say. About Finland passing a law to legalize the presence of nukes on Finnish territory, I think that's a done thing myself. I think we've been heading in that direction from the moment Alexander Stubb became president of Finland.
You think they're going to do it?
Yeah, I think they're going to do it. I mean, they're saying at the moment that they would only agree to host those nukes in times of great crisis. But that's what they're saying now. They'll get the law passed, and then at some point it'll happen.
Well, Nikos's question is, what does that mean?
I don't think it makes any change at all. Now that Finland is in NATO, I mean, that is more probably what's going to happen. And from a geostrategic point of view, it brings American nukes closer to St. Petersburg, which is something obviously that the Russians will be very, very sensitive about. But it also brings the launchers of those missiles much closer to the Russians, where they can attack and destroy them. So what it does in military strategic terms is that it reduces the time warnings, which is very dangerous.
Fed Chair Arthur Burns says, where's Bibi?
I think we just talked about that. Hide. I don't think he's dead. I think he's hiding. I think if he was dead or even injured, we would have got the news about it by now. I think he's hiding.
Callan is a new member to the Durant community. Patrick, thank you for that super chat. Blobzoop says, they've damaged incredible historical sites which are older than the USA. Trump threatened this in his first term. It's deliberate terrorism. They know our fears.
Well, I remember lots of great artworks and archaeological sites were also damaged in Iraq, and they were also damaged in Syria. And I was shocked at how indifferent people were about this. And I wrote articles about it at the time. And I was deeply upset by the fact that nobody seemed to be interested in reading those articles. There were some of the articles that I've written which vanished like a stone in water. So I'm glad that you brought it up because it upsets me terribly, but you know, people don't seem to care very much.
Monty 1054 says, given how many books she's recently read, I wonder why Kaya Kallas still hasn't found a way to reopen the Strait of Hormuz.
Oh, well, I mean, give it time. There are only 17 days. I'm sure Professor Kallas is in on the, is in on the task. I mean, she'll come up with some, you know, miraculous, magical solution. And, you know, it's only probably just 2 or 3 more days and she'll get there.
I would not be surprised if she is appointed a professor somewhere.
Yes. Oh, no, I'm sure.
That would not surprise me.
It'd be interesting to turn up to her lectures, by the way. It might be good for a laugh.
It'll be done in crayons. Anyway, yes. Acharya says, so typically Indiophobic from Pepe, nothing new.
Yeah, well, I'm not familiar with this, but I mean, I am not as pessimistic about Brexit as he is, and I'm more sympathetic to what the Indians are doing. I think they do have very difficult decisions to make. India has a huge population, much of which lives in very difficult conditions. It's not easy for them to make some of the dramatic decisions that they're making, but now they are in serious difficulties because of this crisis at the Strait of Hormuz. And perhaps, and I will say this, perhaps if they'd been a bit more outspoken about the start of this war in the first place, they would be in a better position now than the one they're in.
Tsunami Bomb says, lots of Iranian money is invested abroad because the sanctions prevents money transfers for oil sales home to Iran. Those who impose the sanctions, of course, profit from these Iranian foreign investments they force upon them.
I've encountered this myself. Many of my, I've got Iranian friends in London, and they've told me about this themselves and the problems that this all causes.
Odysseus says, Kallas is reading Dr. Seuss.
Of course. Oh, well, has she advanced to that level yet? If so, then she's making huge progress. She's advancing by strides.
Alexandra says, with the conflicts in Ukraine and Iran, the West is actually confirming how weak we truly are. This war will accelerate the decline of the West.
Well, I come back to the point that I made. I mean, it's not my point. It's actually Willie O'M's point that our entire military system is geared for a battle. We are not really designed. We don't really have the systems to wage long wars. And when we talk about long wars, what we call long wars would not have been considered long wars at previous historical points. If we talk about Russia, the war between Sweden and Russia in the early 18th century lasted for 21 years. Just saying.
Elza says, why are the Europeans more afraid of Iran than of Russia? Do they know that Russia will show more restraint, or do they only care about the oil price?
I think that they probably sense that a conflict with Iran, sending troops to fight Iran, would be so massively unpopular with the European public that they don't really want to go there. In other words, they're more frightened of their own people than they are of Iran.
Michael Herbert says, I see one world war. Zelensky said that Ukraine is the new Israel. In case of collapse of the Zionists, Ukraine could be a plan B.
I don't think so. I think that Ukraine will never have the pole position in the global system that Israel has had for the last, 80 years. So Zelensky says these things, but I don't think we should take them too seriously.
716, I can't read the rest, but the super chat is, greetings, Pepe. Great to see you visit my birthplace, Sinai. Thank you for that. Sparky says, great work, Alex and Alexander. Glad you were able to get the insightful, courageous, and inspired and intrepid Pepe Escobar on the show. Thank you for that, Sparky. Elsa says, does it matter if Spain and Switzerland don't allow the U.S. to use the military bases or the airspace? What can they do when the U.S. ignores them? Is it just symbolic because of Iran and their people?
I don't think they can do very much. I mean, they're located very, very far away. I think the United States has a massive network of bases. I think they can always find workarounds at the most, it is going to inconvenience the US. It's not going to affect the military operations radically. It is interesting that they have spoken out, and it is symbolic in some way.
Say same thing. Symbolic, isn't it? All of the Europe not going along with Trump
Exactly.
I mean, it doesn't look good for Trump. I'm sure he would have preferred to say, I have a coalition of 30 countries. It's the biggest coalition in all of history and all of these things. But he can't say that now.
No.
It remains a coalition of two.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah. Nitswitch says, thanks for the stream. Very informative, as always. Of course. Thank you for that. Irene, thank you for that super sticker. Audio, thank you for that super chat. Empire We Are says, I need to exchange some correspondence with you guys. You said Telegram. I tried. Am I missing something? No. Telegram and...
Telegram works.
It works, yeah. Go to Telegram and then just DM us.
Yeah.
Tapato Matato says, not just the World Cup, but the Olympics. Monty says, if Kai Kallas becomes a professor, she'll be the first AI ever to have achieved something like this.
Absolutely. Another miracle.
Another miracle. Cyrus Troy, thank you for that super chat. Cactus Ray, thank you for that super sticker. Alexander, I think that is everything. Your final thoughts.
That's a brilliant, a brilliant program. And it's been great to have someone like Pepe, who's also been to Iran, spent time in the country, filmed it. Met with the people, talk to them, give us his insight into Iran and the culture and the people there. And because, again, I generally get the sense that people in the West don't understand this country very well. It's not an easy country to get to know, but I think we're profoundly wrong about it in many things.
One sec. Alexander's. All right.
Yeah.
Okay. That is everything. So thank you to everyone that joined us on Odyssey, on Rumble, on YouTube, and on Locals, theduran.locals.com. Also check us out on Substack. Check out the Duran shop for merch. Alexander will be having a video coming out shortly, posted shortly. I will have a video as well. So go to Alexander's channel. Check out the video, subscribe, go to my channel, check out the video, subscribe, and I think that's it. We will see everybody soon. And thank you to our moderators. Thank you to our moderators. Thank you, Zariel, once again for putting this whole thing together.
Yeah.
And from Elza, will Trump remove sanctions on Russia oil just to save face?
He's saying about doing it for 30 days and then reimposing it later. I mean, to me, that makes absolutely no sense at all, by the way, in terms of sanctions policy. I mean, you turn sanctions on like you turn it Russian oil, like a tap on and off when you please, but it's Trump. I think the Russians will make as much money as they can in as short as time as possible. And they probably will say to themselves, if the sanctions are lifted, realistically, they're not coming back.
Yeah. All right. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.